The story of Judas Iscariot raises all sorts of questions for the church. It always has and it always will. And in our first reading tonight, we heard the end of that story. And it gives us a little snapshot into the infant church's confusion and uncertainty about what to make of what happened to Judas. For those who had held the view that God knows everything in advance and that God controls everything absolutely, the defection of Jesus from the company of the apostles turned their world on its head. How could it be that the all-knowing God had chosen as one of his 12 disciples a man who would reject and betray their mission and turn Jesus over to his enemies? And how could an all-powerful God, who had carefully chosen 12 apostles to be the new patriarchs, the representative leadership of a kind of new Israel once Jesus was gone, so carelessly lose one of them and be left with only 11? And the questions were not much less bewildering for those who didn't imagine God as micromanaging everything that happened in the world, because it still raised questions about Jesus. How could someone who had been one of the privileged insiders on the whole ministry of Jesus fail to be fully persuaded that he was God's chosen one? For those who were fully persuaded that Jesus was the Messiah, it was bewildering that one who had been so close to him all the way through his ministry might doubt him and turn against him. How could this be? And for all of us, from then till now, what does Judas's defection and the early church's response to it mean for our understandings of ministry and leadership and the mission of the church? Actually, the thing that surprises me most in this story is something that the text doesn't address at all. And that is that if these questions about the demise of Judas and the need to appoint a replacement for him were such a big deal for the rest of the disciples, as this story suggests, how come it hadn't occurred to them to ask the risen Jesus to explain it all and appoint a replacement himself during the 40 days between the resurrection and the ascension? I'm not going to get an answer to that question, and you'll be pleased to know that I'm not going to preach a speculative sermon about it either. I'm also not going to pursue the questions about the importance of there being 12 apostles because of what it symbolised about the relationship of the church to Israel. Perhaps if I was a little bit braver and a little bit more knowledgeable, it might have been a particularly good angle to take, seeing as we spent the afternoon learning more about the dialogue between Christians and Jews. But all I want to say about it is that it was clearly important to the apostles themselves. Jesus had explicitly connected the idea of the 12 apostles with the 12 tribes of Israel. And immediately prior to the ascension, which Luke relates immediately before the story we heard, the disciples ask the risen Jesus if it is now time for the expected restoration of Israel. They clearly understood the mission of Jesus and the ministry that he was leaving to them in the context of that expectation. But I'm just going to leave that there as the background to this intriguing story of how the infant church went about selecting a replacement for Judas. And I'm going to set out with the more modest aim of exploring a little of what that might tell us about our ministries and leadership now. The first thing that I want to note is that Luke tells the story in such a way as to make it clear that the failure of Judas need not have ruled him out from returning and being accepted as one of the 12. Because Luke appears to quite deliberately present us with Peter as the one who had also spectacularly failed Jesus and who is now emerging forgiven and restored as a key leader in the fledgling church. Both of them had failed. both of them had turned their backs on Jesus, but only one sought and accepted Jesus' mercy. Now, there is no doubt that there are situations today in which we do have to conclude that someone's failure is of a type that it is not safe to entrust them with the responsibilities of pastoral leadership again. But this is only to be seen in terms of ensuring the safety of others, and never as a self-righteous purging of the evildoer from our midst, as though we were so much more pure and perfect ourselves. All of our leaders, and in fact all of us, leaders or not, fail in all sorts of ways. And the leadership that Jesus delegates is always and only shaped by an acknowledgement of our shared brokenness and an absolute dependence on God's healing mercy. The second thing I want to note is the criteria that Peter sets out for a suitable replacement for the missing apostle. He specifies that it must be someone who has been with them during the whole of Jesus' ministry, and that it must be someone who can be a witness to the resurrected Jesus. Given that the Gospels so often focus on the presence of the 12, the big 12, with Jesus, it's nice to have a reminder that actually there were a whole bunch of other men and women who were also followers of Jesus all the way through his ministry and who were thus potentially qualified on this score. But it's also instructive to note that these very criteria would have ruled out the two men who within a very short space of time became the two most prominent leaders of the early church. James, the brother of Jesus, who becomes the leader of the church in Jerusalem, and Paul, who becomes the apostle to the Gentiles, had not been followers of Jesus throughout his ministry. Paul definitely, and so far as we know, James too, had only become believers after Jesus' death and resurrection. So clearly, there is no one definitive set of selection criteria for Christian leadership. It's obvious that only the first generation could have required that its leaders be drawn from those among those who had followed Jesus throughout his ministry. But in fact, even that first generation were very soon accepting the leadership of James and Paul. The Spirit is constantly doing new things and gathering into the church's membership and leadership those who we have previously assumed were unqualified and disallowed. It's only a few decades ago that most of the church agreed that women could not be pastoral leaders in the church. But the Spirit has opened our eyes and shown us how impoverished our life and ministry was without female leadership. Also, just a few decades ago, I could not have been considered suitable for ministry because I had been divorced and remarried. Not many of our churches would still be worried about that, although some of them might think that any reason to exclude me is good enough. But the debates about homosexual people in the church are currently focused on the marriage questions, but as soon as that's behind us, you can bet we will be arguing again about whether homosexuality rules people out of church leadership positions. And no doubt we in the church will once again end up looking back with embarrassment on our resistance to the new things that the Spirit was doing among us and the new people that God was gathering in and blessing into our midst. And when I say new things, they're not nearly as new to the Spirit as they are often surprisingly new to us. Because only a couple of pages later, after this very story, Luke tells us the story that we heard last week of the conversion and baptism of the racially and sexually other Ethiopian eunuch. Sometimes we take an awfully long time to catch up with what the Spirit is doing among us. The third thing that I want to note is how they went about choosing Matthias to fill the empty post. The bit that probably caught your attention was that they tossed a coin or drew lots, which does strike us as awfully random. And we certainly don't do ordination selection by lottery these days. Although I will admit to occasionally having cause to wonder whether we'd get it wrong that much more often if we did. But before I come back to consider the lottery, please know that even here in this story, it certainly wasn't the whole process. Considerable attention is first given to the scriptures to establish whether, in fact, they should be seeking a replacement at all, and if so, what sort. Then they give some attention to agreeing on the criteria. And then they had some sort of process of discernment and consensus, which is not actually described, but which led them to narrow the possibilities down to a short list of two. Then they spent time praying and asking God to show them who God wanted in the role. And only after that did they toss a coin, which sounds a bit like, to me, like the coin toss was perhaps not in the original plan, but was just a tiebreaker when they couldn't sort it out. So please note that the process of selecting our leaders is not to be taken lightly, but carefully and prayerfully. And please note too that discerning the will of God is not something that we are expected to find easy and definitive. Because from the way you hear some Christians talk about God telling them this and God telling them that, you would get the idea that if they'd been there with the Apostle Peter, he could have just asked them and they'd have told him with great certainty who God had chosen. But it seems that the early church was actually a lot more real and a lot more like us, and discerning the will of God was not nearly so simple nor precise. The fourth thing that I want to note does relate directly to the drawing of lots. In this congregation, we are not likely to ever resort to tossing a coin in selecting our leadership group because our host group does not have a fixed number of places that must be filled. But there is an interesting and I think important bit of symbolism that is not very often noted in the drawing of lots in this story. You see, people typically think of Matthias as being the lucky one who was chosen by the drawing of lots, and Justus as the unlucky one for having been left out when the lots were drawn. But is that really what the story is inviting us to think? You see, although there are various stories of with various uses of the drawing of lots in the Hebrew scriptures, one of the most common uses of drawing lots in the ancient world was for choosing the scapegoat to be sacrificed. Even in the Hebrew scriptures, we have a lot of stories where lots are drawn to determine the identity of a guilty party who has brought disaster on the community and who must now be executed in order to restore peace and prosperity to the rest. And note the job description that Peter sets out. One of these must become a witness with us. A witness. Do you know what that word is in Luke's Greek? A martyr. Witness and martyr are actually the same word in Greek. Matthias is chosen the way that a scapegoat is chosen to fill the shoes of a man who had failed and died, and to join the company of early church leaders, many of whom were indeed martyred. That said, the fifth thing that I want to note is that neither Matthias nor Justus are ever heard of again. We have no idea whether he was martyred, or even whether he was a good and faithful servant of the church, or whether perhaps he was just as big a failure as the man he replaced. And that partly reinforces my earlier point about the rapidly evolving understanding and practice of leadership in the early church. The importance of the 12 doesn't seem to have lasted very long. But it also tells us that leadership of the church is not only made up of those who are the charismatic high flyers with spectacular skill sets and significant public profiles and impressive performance indicators, which, speaking as a member of the rather modestly skilled and frequently inefficient leadership group of this particular church, is a big relief to us, I can assure you. And part of why it is a relief is that the subsequent anonymity of Matthias reminds us that in the final analysis, there are not really big and small jobs in the ministry that Jesus has left us. There are just our jobs and other people's jobs. We are all called to play a part, and all the parts are important, whether they have high profiles or not. And all any of us are called to do is play our part faithfully and without seeking to draw attention to ourselves. And when we're getting it right, all the attention is being drawn to Jesus, the crucified and risen one. Now, given the prominence of the symbolic number 12 in this story, it's a little tempting to go on and try and find another 7 important lessons to note so that I can have 12 points, but I am out of time, and that would probably just be trying to be clever for no real purpose. So let me wrap up by urging us all to take these things seriously in our understanding and our practice of congregational leadership here. Because obviously Alison and I, as your pastors, have the most visible leadership roles among you. But this church is very dependent on everyone playing their roles, including various other leadership roles. Some of them are as low-key and anonymous as Matthias apparently was, but they still need your prayerful support and encouragement. And maybe they also need you to step up and to join them in a role that you haven't yet imagined for yourself. Maybe you know that God is asking you to get involved in new ways and to offer gifts that you haven't previously offered. We won't be drawing lots or seeking to martyr you. But we do see that your own sensing of the call of God is an important part of the process of identifying our leaders, our ministers, our role players. So if you're sensing that maybe there is a new task opening up before you, don't be afraid to come and talk to one of us, me or Alison or someone else on the host group, about it. We're here to help you discern God's call. Because ultimately, when all of us are responding to God's varying calls on our individual lives, and all of us together are responding by becoming the kind of community that God is calling us to be, then forgiven failures though we all will be, we will together truly be a witness to the resurrected one and to the resurrection life he's sharing with us and shares with us now around this table and among these people.